Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. Thank you all for being here. Thank you all online for being here. Thank you all later in the week for listening online. It's good to have everybody here. I want to thank my wife, Susan, and everybody else who namelessly bring treats every week. They're fantastic. So, if you're online and you're in the Sierra Madre, California neighborhood, stop by. We'd love to have you live rather than online. It makes it a much more interesting experience. Dr. Ross asked me while I'm up here to tell a couple of jokes. So here we go. These are science jokes, so put on your thinking cap, right? Okay, so think this. Focus on this, think about this. A biologist, a physicist, and a mathematician are standing in front of an empty house. They all observe two people go in and three people walk out. The biologist tries to explain the phenomenon by stating, well, they must have reproduced. The physicist offers a different explanation. There must have been an error in measurement. But the mathematician says if one more person walks in, then the house will be empty again. I got Hugh to laugh, and that's all I care about. Yeah, that's the next one. Here we go, okay? Werner Heisenberg was speeding down the highway. The cop pulls him over, and he says, "Do you have any idea how fast you were going?" And Heisenberg says, "No, I can't, but I knew where I was." All right. They're funny. You got to look them up. Let's say a prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for the opportunity that we can worship you freely and openly. Lord, the world is changing so quickly, Lord, and we ask that as followers of you, that we really learn what our priorities are, that we keep our mind focused on you, focused on Christ, focused on what it is that we're supposed to be doing here. We thank you for this class, Lord. Let this class be part of that knowledge that we are amassing to be able to follow you. Thank you for Dr. Ross. Thank you for this class and all he has meant to me and each one of us. Bless us each as we go our way this afternoon. Thank you, in Jesus' name, amen. Please welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Well, again, thank you for showing up here and for all of you that are participating online. And it's been amazing to me just the recovery from the pandemic. Now, only recently are we seeing people doing in-person events. And what I'm now recognizing is the return of the apologetics conferences. 2 weeks ago, I was in Honolulu doing an apologetics conference. And this past Friday and Saturday, I was participating in an apologetics conference in Corona. And I think we may need to turn that microphone down. We're getting some feedback on it. Just so that you're aware, we're going to again restart Reasons Forum. You may remember before the pandemic, we were having these monthly meetings at Reasons to Believe headquarters, and we learned a lesson from that. We were focusing on the virtual audience, and therefore we had them at 5 p.m., and wondering why there were so few people that showed up. Well, I mean, it takes time to go from work. So what we're now going to do, we're going to target the West Coast audience. And you know, people can participate online, of course, but that's going to be starting up soon. But one thing I wanted to share with you that I think will encourage all of us who are followers of Jesus Christ, as I saw this happen both in the Oahu Apologetics Conference and yesterday and on Friday, people coming up to me and saying, "I heard you speak in 1990 at a church in Orange County, and you know, it was transformative in my life. It really turned my Christian life around." And I ran into another fellow who said, In 1989, somebody gave me your book, The Fingerprint of God, and that was the book that got me on the pathway to giving my life to Jesus Christ. And my whole point is, 1990, 1989, that's 33 and 34 years ago. And it's been my experience, you know, I'm a lot older than many of you here in the audience, is that you will not see the fruit of your ministry, but persevere, you will eventually see it. And when you get to be with the Lord, then you're really going to see the fruit of your ministry. So please just be patient. And I've been noticing in the 40 plus years I've been involved in the Christian ministry, people typically tell me the impact of them reading one of my books or hearing me speak or meeting me as a stranger in an airport or whatever. I hear about that 20, 25, 30 years later. And so just be encouraged that if you plant your seeds, if you share your faith, there will be fruit. And you know, if you wait long enough, you'll see a bit of the fruit, but you're still only going to see the tip of the iceberg. Well, what I announced on social media is we're going to continue this series on human exceptionalism. And the question I want to address this afternoon is, are Neanderthals human? And I notice that we at Reasons to Believe tend to stand alone on this concept amongst different science faith organizations, namely that you've got all the young earth creationist communities and organizations who insist that Neanderthals are fully human and that Adam and Eve gave rise to the Neanderthals and Homo erectus and the Denisovans. And as we've engaged theistic evolutionists, likewise, they claim that Neanderthals are fully human. And you know, as I have been engaging people at the Discovery Institute, I don't know whether it's true of all of them, but I know the people writing on this also insist that Neanderthals are part of the human species. And therefore, these leaders have been getting on my case saying, why do you insist on standing alone and saying that Neanderthals and humans are distinct? Well, I want to address that because I think this is a significant issue. Number one, as I read scripture, it tells us that all of humanity is descended from one man and one woman, Adam and Eve, that God specially created. And in Genesis chapter 2, it tells us that God created Adam and Eve and put them in the Garden of Eden. And it's a place where four known rivers come together. The Tigris and Euphrates that flow out of the land of Asher. The text tells us where they flow from, namely the region that we would identify today as modern-day Iraq. And then it talks about the Pishon flowing out of the mountains of Havilah, where there is gold. And these are the mountains that are in the central western part of the Arabian Peninsula. And then it talks about the Gihon that flows out of the mountains of Kush, which refers to the southwestern part of Arabia. And two of those rivers flow today, the Tigris and the Euphrates. Why? Because they're fed by melting snow on the mountains of Ararat, and the Gihon, the Pishon, are dry because the mountains from which they originate no longer have snow. But we can see the dry riverbeds, and these four rivers come together in a location that is now 200 feet below sea level, basically the southeastern part of the Persian Gulf. But during the last ice age, that region was above sea level, 50 to 80 feet above sea level, which implies that God created Adam and Eve sometime during an ice age when the sea levels were about 300 to 390 feet lower than what they are today. So, and I've talked about this before, but I want to show you a side-by-side comparison. Are Neanderthals human? And I remember talking about this when we launched Reasons to Believe 37 years ago. We had a TV show at that time, and I interviewed a couple of Christian anthropologists, and they insisted that humans and Neanderthals were anatomically identical, that we could see no anatomical differences between Neanderthals and humans, and therefore Neanderthals must be humans. We now know that's not true. In fact, whether you're a young earth creationist, a theistic evolutionist, or an atheist anthropologist, there's now a consensus that that there is an anatomical distinctiveness between Neanderthals and humans. Neanderthals had the shorter arms and legs, a barrel-shaped body, all designed to retain heat because they lived in a fairly cold climate. But what has become known recently is that one of the areas where you see the greatest anatomical distinctives is in the head and the brain. And so I found this image online, which is basically a side-by-side comparison of the human and Neanderthal skull. And so you see the human on the left, the Neanderthal on the right. And right away, I think it becomes clear, we really are looking at two very different species. Look at how different their skull structure is. And in particular, you see that the Neanderthal has an elongated skull cap for the brain, whereas for the human, it's globular. Now, looking at this image, the way it's portrayed, you would think, wow, looks like Neanderthal has got a bigger brain than a human. The truth is the brain size is approximately the same for both modern humans and Neanderthals. The difference is with the Neanderthal, the skull is elongated, so it's narrower and longer, and the human skull is globular. But it's that globular structure we've shared before here in this class that actually allows room for the parietal lobes, and it's those parietal lobes that enable us to engage in complex speech, to be able to do mathematics, philosophy, to engage in symbolism, and actually supports the spiritual expression of humans. But you see many other anatomical distinctives. People notice is that, look at the skull structure above the eyes. You see this very heavy bone structure above the eyes for the Neanderthals. The eye sockets are bigger and circular compared to humans. And one of the biggest differences is the jaw structure you can see is radically different. The Neanderthals have a much stronger jaw, powerful jaw, and then the nasal capacity is something that has been discovered. The Neanderthals had a very large nasal capacity compared to we human beings. Again, a crucial feature for them to enable them to be able to breathe in cold air and have that air warm up before it went into their lungs. And you know, we humans can do that too. We can live in a cold climate, but we need to wear clothing that basically simulates what you get in the skull of the Neanderthal so that the air gets warm before it comes in. So there's no longer a dispute on this. Regardless of people's theological perspective, they do agree that humans and Neanderthals are anatomically distinct from one another. And you can pick up the past recordings of the Paradoxes class. We also had a discussion. They're genetically distinct. And this map here shows you the habitat area of the Neanderthals. And we see three subpopulations of Neanderthals. You got the Neanderthals that populate France and Spain and parts of Italy and Romania. And that's that blue area. And then we see another subpopulation that's basically in southern Turkey and in Syria. And then you see the ones that are out in Siberia. That's the purple one and the little green one. And what we now recognize is that Neanderthals were living in isolated population groups. So unlike we humans, where we kind of have a large population, remain in contact with one another, what they're now recognizing is that even though they had this vast habitat region, that the population, subpopulation groups were separated from one another. Where they found the greatest number of fossil remains is in the western part. So when you see that blue part there, that's the bulk of the evidence for Neanderthals. The first Neanderthal specimen was found in Germany, and then now they found several in particularly France and Spain. And we have just a small amount of evidence in Siberia and there in southern Turkey. And we now recognize too that the population level in Neanderthals was small, probably no larger than 8,000 individuals, and spread out over this huge region. The population density of Neanderthals over their habitat region actually works out to 0.002 per square mile. which basically explains the genetics that we see in the Neanderthals. When we look at the genetics, we can see that they were living in small family tribal groups and that they were highly inbred, which means that the small family groups were not engaging with other small family groups. They were widely separated. They didn't have contact with one another, and probably explains why the Neanderthals faced a sudden extinction event about 45,000 years ago. They were just simply way too inbred. Their population was much too small. Now, you would think if you look at the morphological differences, the anatomical differences, and the genetic differences, that would settle the debate and people would agree, yes, Neanderthals are not humans. They're a distinct species from humans. But what I've been noticing in the scientific literature is rather than these anthropologists focusing on the evidence that has the greatest security and the least amount of uncertainty, namely the morphological differences and to a lesser degree the genetic differences, instead they focus on the behavioral differences. And they're claiming, based on the behavioral things that we're seeing in Neanderthals, that they're basically one and the same species with us. And just as I'll get into this, but the whole point is that the behavioral data we have on Neanderthals is very challenging to interpret. It's subjective evidence, it's not objective evidence. People are looking at the artifacts left behind by Neanderthals, and they're making presumptions about their behavior, and assuming their behavior was identical to that of early humans, and basically not paying attention to the fact, well, look at the anatomical differences. They're so dramatically different, there's no way that they can be one and the same with us human beings. Likewise with the genetics. But instead, people are looking at what they refer to as Neanderthal technology and drawing the conclusion that they're just like us, and therefore we need to include the Neanderthals as part of the human species. So they will cite evidence that looks like they were burying their dead, looks like they had control over fire, they had musical instruments, apparently advanced tools, and their use of symbols. Notice I put question marks beside all of this, because in each case, these claims are being disputed. It's not like looking at the bones where you can make measurements and draw very specific conclusions, or looking at the DNA and likewise being able to draw it, is that we do see evidence that are being interpreted in a subjective fashion. And to be more specific about this, we're seeing no undisputed evidence that they wore clothes. And so, again, all the attention's being put on the technology and people are not really paying appropriate attention to the anatomical and the genetic differences. And so, I put the word undisputed for number six there, but the truth is I could put it in every single one of them. And what I'm trying to do is basically encourage people. I'm getting a lot of questions on my social media saying, what about this paper that was published that claims that Neanderthals had control over fire? I said, well, that paper is in the peer-reviewed literature, but have you read the other papers that respond to that claim? And what you discover is the majority of anthropologists would dispute the claim that's being made that they had control over fire. And then there's a subtlety of interpretation. They were certainly using fire. There's a difference, though, between using fire and having control over fire. And what my colleague Fazal Rana at Reasons to Believe has been doing is saying, yes, we see evidence that Neanderthals apparently had control over fire. And again, I say apparently because it's not concrete, but he said, notice, it's no different than the evidence we have of chimpanzees having control over fire. Just like chimpanzees, when a wildfire breaks out in the jungle, they rapidly gather up all the nuts they have that they can't crack open with their stone tools. They throw all the nuts on the wildfire. They run away from the wildfire, but after the wildfire is over, they go back and they gather up all these roasted nuts, and now they can crack them open with their stone tools and they have a feast. And what we're seeing with Neanderthals is similar to that, that yes, And as Fuzz has been pointing out in his articles, if they really had control over fire, if the Neanderthals really had control over fire, we would expect the bulk of that evidence to be in the wintertime. But in fact, the evidence is in the summertime. And the summertime is when you're more likely to have wildfires. And if they really had hearths, if they really had the ability to start a fire from scratch, you'd expect that there'd be evidence that they were cooking their food. And again, there are people saying, we think they were cooking their food, but they, again, the claims are disputed. And so in terms of looking at the scientific literature, it's not enough for someone to say, hey, here's a paper that says that Neanderthals were wearing clothes, or Neanderthals had controlled fire, or that Neanderthals were engaged in complex symbolic expression. That paper has to be judged in the context of the peers that are responding to that and saying, okay, let's look at the symbol evidence you're talking about. It turns out it's three scratches, vertical scratches on a cave wall. Is that really symbolic expression? Well, I mean, if you got three horizontal scratches and a vertical scratch, that's the letter E, right? Even then, you might be a little bit suspicious. Is it possible that a bear with claws made those three vertical marks? And maybe we made the side mark as well. And so you need to look at, okay, what kind of interpretation are we bringing into that? Radically different from what you see with human beings. So for example, the first thing that we see with humans in terms of symbolic expression are the totem poles of the Western Native peoples of North America. They were erecting these poles and they were carving into them. And you can look at the carving and realize, you know what? This actually is older than the oldest writings we see in Sumeria and of Babylon. That dates back to about 5,500 years ago. But on the west coast of North America, we have totem poles with complex carvings in there that record the rising of the sea level. And basically, there is a land bridge joining the Queen Charlotte Islands to the mainland of British Columbia, and the natives were walking back and forth. But then the sea level began to rise, and it rose so rapidly that the peoples living on the Queen Charlottes developed a plan saying, hey, the sea level's rising, we need to get back to the mainland. But the totem pole carvings basically record the fact that the sea level rose at such a rapid rate, they were not able to escape the Queen Charlottes and get back to the mainland. And so for 10,500 years, they were cut off from the rest of humanity. We see nothing like that with the Neanderthals. At best, all we find are some vertical scratches on a cave wall that people who want to believe that Neanderthals are as advanced as saying, well, maybe that's symbolic expression. Could be, but there's a lot of reasons why we would think that that's not the case. And then I'll be talking to you, in fact, I got a photo I just found. I don't have it ready for you today, but I'll have it ready the next time I'm here, where they're actually claiming that Neanderthals were building homes. And the evidence basically is they found this cave. And you know, the fact that we're seeing all this evidence for Neanderthals exclusively in caves basically can be used, it's been pointed out in the literature, the claim that they were actually wearing clothes and had the capability of manufacturing clothing seems to be disputed by the fact that the evidence we have for Neanderthals is basically constrained to a few caves. And if you don't have clothes, that's where you're gonna go. You're gonna go into a cave because that gives you some protection from the elements. But the claim that they were actually constructing dwelling, again, it's a single paper referring to one cave, only one cave, where they found a bunch of stalactites all kind of crumpled up in an area. I'm going to actually show you the photograph of it. And they see all these littered stalactites, and they're basically saying that's evidence that Neanderthals had actually used these stalactites to create a dwelling, a building inside the cave. But it could be just random stalactites that broke off. I mean, I've been in these caves that have these stalactites that are in there, and they do break, and you do see them littering around. But that's kind of what we're dealing with. People walking into a cave, they find a Neanderthal bone in the cave, and they assume with all these broken stalactites that the Neanderthals must have built a complex dwelling inside there, and therefore saying they're humans like us. Okay, what I want to focus on, I think I got time to do this, is that the two pieces of evidence that are most frequently cited to claim that Neanderthals were just as mathematically capable as we humans and just as technologically advanced as us is evidence that they were actually able to manufacture fabrics by being able to work with twine and be able to weave, and that they were weaving clothing. And so, because the limit we have in terms of hard evidence of Neanderthals having some kind of clothing is that we find a Neanderthal bone next to the hide, part of the hide of an animal. And there again, people are saying, well, we found part of the hide of an animal. We found a bone that belongs to Neanderthal. We think the Neanderthals were using the hides and putting them over themselves as capes, or using them over themselves when they slept. Well, maybe, but maybe not. We don't know. But the paper that's been most frequently cited is saying they not only were using animal skins, they were actually weaving together threads and to make clothing and make actually sophisticated baskets. And it's all based on this one thing that they found inside a Neanderthal cave. Inside a Neanderthal cave, they found this. That's a magnified image of a piece of thread that they found in the cave. Here, I'll kind of give you an image there. And so these are three tiny threads. And if you go to the very bottom, here's a schematic of it. It shows the three threads coming together at the bottom. And they're saying there's three threads there that are weaved together. And they're citing this as evidence that they believe that, hey, since this is found in the same cave where we found a Neanderthal bone, Neanderthals were actually involved in sophisticated weaving. Now, I want you to pay attention to the measurement there, 1 millimeter. This is not a big piece of thread. We're talking just a millimeter. And the place where you see the three threads being woven together, again, a little more than 1 millimeter. And so this raises a question. Given the brain structure that we know of Neanderthals, that elongated, flat cranial cavity, and the way the eyes are, could they have had the eye hand coordination to be able to take three tiny threads, literally just a millimeter, and be able to weave them together? And you see, this is the total of the evidence that they have for weaving. Just as one little knot at the bottom where you got three threads coming together. Nowhere else do we see any evidence of weaving. And what I want to share with you is what the researchers said when they discovered this. This was their conclusion. Understanding the use of twisted fibers implies the use of complex multi-component technologies, as well as the understanding of pairs, sets, and numbers. So they took this evidence of these three threads being woven together to make this weave, and claiming that Neanderthals therefore had the capability of the mathematics of set theory and number theory. And then they go on to make the claim, the idea that Neanderthals were cognitively inferior to modern humans is becoming increasingly untenable. And this is what was put on NBC News. The world's oldest yarn hints that Neanderthals have basic math skills. That's all in the paper. And this paper has been widely cited. What has not been widely cited, however, is the fact that this claim has been broadly disputed by the fellow anthropologists in the anthropology research community. It's been widely refuted and disputed. Nevertheless, this gets cited all the time as evidence that Neanderthals were just as mathematically advanced as us. And I kind of looked at this and said, how do you get set theory out of these three threads that are woven together with this one little tiny, it's not even a knot, It's just three threads that are kind of woven together, and it's only 1 millimeter. How do you get set theory out of that? How do you get a number system out of that? Well, I read the paper. They said, well, if you got three threads, that's number one, number two, number three. Therefore, these Neanderthals had the ability to count, just like we humans count. Well, maybe. But let me give you some of the responses from the critics of this particular claim. The string was found in a cave at level 4.2, and they dated this, and this is where they made the claim it had to be Neanderthal, because the dating that they applied came up with dates of 41,000 years ago, plus or minus 2,000, 46,000 years ago, plus or minus 5,000, and 52,000 years ago, plus or minus 2,000. And they looked at that 52,000 date, and they said humans did not get to that region until about 45,000 years ago. Therefore, it must have been Neanderthals. But notice that the other two dates, 41,000, 46,000, do fall within the range of when humans could have been in that area. And so a number of anthropologists have said, maybe we've misidentified who's responsible for this twine. It could have been humans and not Neanderthals at all. And so I've written an article on this. You'll see it at reasons.org where I make the point, well, let's actually look into the techniques that they used to come up with these dates. Because look at the error bars, plus or minus 2, plus or minus 5, plus or minus 2. Those are really quite small error bars given how far back they are. But what I discovered is that all those dates were not done through radiocarbon analysis. Rather, they were done through electron spin resonance and the uranium-thorium dating method. And again, this is a problem for the non-expert because they look at uranium-thorium dating and they think that's a radiometric tool. It's not a radiometric tool. What it is, it's a tool based on the fact that uranium can be precipitated by water, but thorium cannot be precipitated by water. And so they're basically measuring the degree of uranium that they see relative to the degree of thorium and making assumptions about the precipitation. They then come up with a date. And the electron spin resonance method is akin to what's called optical luminescence and thermoluminescence. And basically you look at minerals within the sample and basically determine how long has that sample been exposed to light, or how long has it been cut off from being exposed to light, and they draw a conclusion on the date. And so the uranium electron spin resonance, it measures the amount of unpaired electrons previously exposed to natural radiation, that is light. However, to get an accurate date, you need to know the past natural radiation rate and its intensity to get the sample, and you're also assuming the sample has not been re-exposed to light, or you have to assume. And therefore, what kind of error bar do you get? Well, the plus or minus two that they record there is what we call the statistical error. You basically take different samples and measure the differences. However, it doesn't take into account the problem of the assumptions. The assumption that has been completely cut off from light that entire time. If that's not the case, that shifts all the measurements either to the left or to the right. And so you might have plus or minus two in terms of what we call the random or the statistical errors, what we call the systematic errors, the errors generated by the fact that the assumptions you bring into this may be incorrect, are basically plus or minus 2,000%. And so that number of 41,000 or that number of 52,000, it literally could be off by a factor of 50,000 years up or down. And so to draw a conclusion based on these indirect dating methods is a problem. Likewise with uranium-thorium, it measures how long ago a sample has been precipitated from water. So here again, you have to make the assumption that it's had no future contact with the water. You also have to assume that the original contact with water, you have to assume how much water was there and the effect that water would have had on precipitating the uranium. Thorium is not soluble in water, but uranium is. However, the uranium decays into thorium. And so when you determine the ratio of thorium to uranium in a sample to yield the age, only if one knows the sample is entirely from a single rapid precipitation event. That's the key assumption. There's been one rapid and very wet, a soaking wet precipitation event. And if that's the case, then you can trust the date that's there. But if it's ever been exposed to moisture, either before or after, the date that you get could be way off, up or down. And so the date of 41,000 plus or minus 2,000 years does not rule out modern humans. It may rule out the Neanderthals. That's what's interesting, is that if your assumptions are such that the date is younger than 41,000 years, that would definitively rule out Neanderthals, because we know they went extinct about 45,000 years ago. And so the claim in the paper is this definitively, with a 52,000 year date, tells us it can't be human, it must be Neanderthal. But actually the weight of evidence is probably more significant the other way around. It's more likely to be human than it can be done with Neanderthal. Although I'm personally of the opinion that this particular weave was not done by Neanderthals or done by humans. And so I'll drive into that, in the sense that we can see birds performing knots of this nature, even more complex than that. Birds, unlike the great apes and Neanderthals, actually had the eye-hand coordination, or the eye-beak coordination, to do this kind of weaving. And what I find interesting is we don't attribute set theory to birds just because they can weave a nest with these complex weave patterns. We don't attribute a capacity for a complex number system. We're not attributing mathematical knowledge to these birds, and yet this is what's being done in this case with respect to the Neanderthals. Now we're looking at a weave here that has been outstripped by birds. Birds are capable of making many more complex than what we see here. And also, I'm thinking it could be pure entropy, namely that these threads kind of weave themselves. And this is all we see, is three threads that come together and they weave together, but it's only a 1 millimeter section. Now, I grew up in coastal British Columbia, and I loved to hike in the forest when I was growing up. And the forest, especially in the wet part of British Columbia, you get these threads coming off the trees. It comes off of the needles, the leaves, the bark. You get these thin threads of cellulose being peeled off of these trees and leaves all the time. And as they fall towards the ground, they make contact with one another. And I've personally seen many weaves of this nature that are equal to what we see in this image that got published, and it's pure entropy. It wasn't done by birds, it wasn't done by humans, it wasn't done by Neanderthals. It's just simply these random threads being expressed by the plant vegetation there, and as they make contact with one another, given the wind and the rain that's taking place, you do see these weave patterns. It's quite frequent. And I remember talking to one anthropologist and said, what you need to do is hike in one of these forests and see how frequently you run into these kinds of weaves. It's, you know, from my own personal experience, it happens a lot. And therefore, I'm of the opinion it's either the birds or it's entropy that's responsible for these. Many bird species possess the brain structure for IB coordination to weave fibers. We see this in real time. Neanderthals lacked such a brain structure, so they wouldn't be able to do it. We can do it, the birds can do it, and then the weaves in the string may not be made by an animal at all. Entropy may have done it, and a bird may have woven the string. A human may have woven the string, but to attribute to a Neanderthal, in my opinion, is a mistake. And as I pointed out, we certainly don't attribute any mathematical understanding to the weaving accomplishment of birds, certainly not set theory. And Fazrana and myself actually did a Facebook Live on this. Did Neanderthals invent string? Were they weaving string? So you can listen to that on YouTube. What I'll share with you next week, next time I'm with you, I think we got Robert Covolo doing part two of a series on Abraham Kuyper next week. Mark Clark is going to be speaking. Okay, so you'll hear from Mark. By the way, Mark is finishing up a book on Daniel. Mark Clark is a national securities expert. In fact, he heads up a coalition of 8 different universities that are working on national security, artificial intelligence, working on training people to discern things. And so what he's been attracted to is looking at the book of Daniel and seeing how Daniel is the prime minister of both the Babylonian Empire, and when it got conquered, the Persians made him the prime minister of their empire. And so what he's done is he's written a book on the understanding of Daniel with national security interests of 2 different empires that were at war with one another, and how he applied biblical principles to national security imperatives. He'll be speaking on that. I don't know what he's going to speak on, but feel free to ask him questions on that, because his book is eminently being prepared for publication. I don't know if anyone has ever written a commentary on the book of Daniel. And he's basically saying it's not just national security experts. All of us need to emulate Daniel. Daniel is a prime biblical example of being in a position of power and authority, but he was a slave. He had to answer to higher authorities, and how he appealed to those higher authorities, and how he maintained his Christian principles. You know, Mark Clark told me that he had been encouraged many times to run for Congress. And his hesitation was, if I run for Congress, I'm going to be facing a lot of challenges. It's going to be really challenging to maintain my Christian character and my Christian principles if I run for Congress. And moreover, I'm not going to have time to do a lot of other things I want to do. But what he's writing about in his book on Daniel is how Daniel was able to maintain his Christian principles in spite of very challenging pressures by the governments he was responsible for to abandon those Christian principles. And Mark's whole point is that's the challenge of every politician. And he says, I've known a lot of Christians who've gone into politics and they've not been able to follow the example of Daniel. That's why he's writing the book. He's basically writing the book for people who are going into government positions, going into the military, going into politics, and how do you maintain your Christian principles when you're under that kind of pressure. So that's Mark Clark next week. But when I come back, I'm going to talk about the second major challenge. And it's this claim of a thread where they see this weave, where their people are drawing the conclusion Neanderthals were technologically advanced. The other big claim is they found some spears that they think demonstrate that Neanderthals are technologically advanced. I'm seeing this in the theological literature where they're saying, you guys at Reasons to Believe are mistaken. Look at these very advanced spears. This is proof that Neanderthals are just as advanced as us. Again, I'm going to make the point, read the scientific literature. Yes, there is a paper where they're claiming these spears were demonstrating that they were technologically advanced, but look at all the papers that are disputing and refuting the claim that's being made. So we'll get into that when I come back, and I'll take questions. And as usual, I'll take questions on any topic. Doesn't have to be what we're talking about here, but if you want to bring up stuff, that's fine too. And we'll alternate between people here in person and those that are participating online. And just so that you're encouraged, our online audience is growing. I think what's especially encouraging is how many of them are actually participating overseas. It looks like we got an online question.
Go ahead.
Dr. Ross, your discussion brings a question to my mind. Between the two theories of old earth Christians, where do Adam and Eve fit in these two theories while this conflict exists?
What's interesting is that both Christians who are theistic evolutionists and Christians who are young earth creationists are now united in saying Neanderthals are part of the descendants of Adam and Eve. Now, theistic evolutionists, many of them will say, we don't believe that there was a literal Adam and a literal Eve. We think humanity came from a population, at least 10,000 individuals, of which Neanderthals were a part. Whereas young earth creationists will say, we believe that all came from Adam and Eve, and that would include what we identify as modern humans, Neanderthals, Denisovans, and even Homo erectus would be part of the descendants. Where they differ is that young earth creationists claim that Adam and Eve were created recently by God, less than 10,000 years ago, and therefore they claim all this evidence for Neanderthals existing 45,000 to 300,000 years ago, they're claiming those dates are wrong. And therefore they're saying that Adam and Eve was created 10,000 years ago. The Neanderthals appear later than that. And so that's where they differ from the theistic evolutionists. The theistic evolutionists put the Neanderthals back where the secular scientists claim that they've been dated. And I'm sympathetic to that. You know, I made the point that a lot of the dates that we see here are subjective. The uranium-thorium dating method, this electron spin resonance, thermal and optical luminescence, they have huge systematic errors. However, we do have a direct dating measure based on carbon-14. But its reliability begins to dissipate once you get older than 40,000 years. And if you go back about 275,000 years ago, you pick up another radiometric tool. But there's a window between about 40,000 and 275,000 years ago where we do not have a direct dating method. And that explains a lot of the uncertainty that goes on for these dates. But young earth creationists take advantage of that and say, the dates are not accurate. It all happens in less than 10,000 years. But they lump all the Neanderthal evidence in there, whereas theistic evolutionists would say, no, that evidence dates much earlier.
You want to follow up?
Yes. So maybe I misstated it. Where do the old earth creation Christian, you being one of them, how do they place Adam and Eve? Yes.
I'll give you the reasons to believe position, and it's a unique position. We do believe that Adam and Eve were created recently, a special creation by God, and that 100% of humanity is descended from Adam and Eve. Based on Genesis 2, we believe that that took place most likely during the last ice age, which would mean, and we got a carbon-14 date that tell us that humans have been around for 45,000 years, 40 to 45,000 years. I don't think that's disputed. In fact, as I read the account of Noah's flood, I look at that as an ice age event as well, because of how long it took the waters to recede. And then you'd have to have Adam and Eve earlier than that. So I think it's most likely fairly early during the last ice age, we got God creating Adam and Eve. You say, what date range are you talking about? Well, somewhere between, say, 40, 45,000 years ago and 130,000 years ago. The secular scientific date for the origin of a humans is 150,000 years ago, plus or minus 150,000 years. That's based on people who recognize the systematic errors. I mean, you'll see some people in the published literature where they only quote the statistical or the random errors, and they'll claim a more accurate date. But honestly, if you take into account the systematic errors, the best scientific date is nowhere near as accurate as the best biblical date. But the best biblical date and the best scientific date do agree within the error bars. There's no conflict between the two dating methods. That's the old earth position we take at Reasons to Believe. And our position is that Neanderthals are not human. Neanderthals predated humans. The Denisovans are not human. Homo erectus is not human. And mainly we point out, if you actually look at their technological capability, we can't find anything that's undisputed that puts their level of technology at a higher level than the monkeys and the modern apes that share the planet with us today. And no one that I can see in the anthropological community looks at the technological capability of capuchin monkeys in Brazil that I mentioned last time, the chimpanzees in Africa, and claim that they're just as technologically advanced as us. No one is making that kind of claim. But from what I can tell reading the scientific literature, we see nothing in the Neanderthal technology that we can demonstrate in an undisputed way is superior to what we already see in capuchin monkeys and in Neanderthals. So that's the position we hold at Reasons to Believe.
We have a question online from Keith Wilson. He says, how do you regard the analogical interpretation of Genesis 1?
Okay, the analogical day view has been popularized by, I'm trying to think of his name. He's the one who's written a nice big thick book on the first four chapters of Genesis. Jack Collins. See John Collins or Jack Collins. We're friends. I've known him for a couple of decades. Good scholar. He's an MIT engineer that decided to get a PhD in biblical languages and theology. One of the world's top experts in how to understand the original Hebrew. He's the one that's been most responsible for promoting the analogical day view, which is the view that the creation days in Genesis 1 are an analogy for God's time period. So his whole point is, yes, you see this 6 days of creation in Genesis 1. We should not interpret that as being equivalent to 144 hours. It's actually an analogy for a significantly longer period of time. So he is an old earth creationist, but he says, I'm not saying, like we have the day-age view at Reasons to Believe, and I would point out that the day-age view is a subset of the analogical day view. Everyone who holds to an analogy, depends on the analogy you want. Is it a very long period of time? Is it longer than 24 hours? But 100% of those theologians who hold to the analogical day view are old earth creationists, but they have different views on how long these different days are. And for that matter, I don't think we can put accurate dates. People keep asking me, Hugh, can you please provide a chart that you can put up at reasons.org that tells us exactly where creation day one begins, where creation day two starts, day three starts, day four starts? And my response is, number one, I do agree with Jack Collins, is that the Bible doesn't put definitive dates on just how long these days are and the sequence of the dates and the dates for each one, and the science isn't that accurate either. I do think we can come up with some scientific dates for the start and stop times of the different creation days, but we can't do it for all 6 days. And again, it's in dispute. The position we take is that creation day one begins when God creates the first microbes on planet Earth, and that date is 3.825 billion years ago. But where does creation day one, where do we get the water cycle set up? That date has a rather broad error bar range. And so people have been saying, well, can you please produce a chart where you put all the error bars in? Well, we could do that, but that's likely to change with respect to time. And people said, well, what I've been telling people, we'll put out a chart when the scientists produce the accurate dates, but from my perspective, that'll never happen. I think we know a very good date when creation day one began and when creation day six ended. I think we also can look at the scientific record and discern these creation days seem to get shorter and shorter as you go from day one to day six. Day one is the longest of the six creation days. Day six is the shortest of the creation days. But as far as precise dates, we don't have those precise dates.
Hi, Hugh. You've talked quite a bit at different times here about statistical and systematic errors and how that how that applies in particular to the to the data that you presented today. But I wanted to compare that, or just give the example that you could comment on. Is you've also given us a date of about 3.8 billion years of the first evidence of life. And if you just explain, oh, we can be assured that the systemic errors there are really small.
That's a good question. You'll find an article at reasons.org I wrote about a year ago, and it's called Human Origins Dating. And basically looks at all the different dating methods that scientists have applied to the origin of humanity, and I discuss which dates, what the systematic and statistical errors are on each of the dating methods. But in terms of the broad dating scheme, from the beginning of the universe up to the present moment, there are regions within that 13.8 billion years where we got really good direct dating tools. But then there are spots within that 13.8 billion year region where we don't have direct dating tool methods. We have to use these indirect methods that depend on assumptions that we make. So one reason why we know that 3.825 billion year date for the first microbes on planet, or at least the first stable microbes on planet Earth, is accurate, it's based on uranium dating and thorium dating, and we're not talking about precipitation. We're talking about the direct radiometric decay of uranium-238 into lead-206 and thorium-232 into lead-208, and also looking at uranium-235 as it decays into lead-207. And so those are direct methods. They're based on known radiometric half-lives that have never changed over time. We can actually look at distant stars and determine that the radiometric decay rates have never changed. The Bible tells us the laws of physics don't change. So we got both the Bible and astronomical measurements telling us that these physical constants and decay rates have not changed over the history of the Earth, which means we can trust these radiometric decay dating tools to give us an accurate date, and where you don't really have a systematic error, you only have a statistical error, which explains why when they published the paper for isotope evidence for the origin of life, the error bar was plus or minus 0.006 billion. And that date includes both the systematic effects and the random effects. You can only do that, however, in terms of Earth history, if you've got a radiometric dating method where the half-life is roughly where the date is. And so like with uranium-238, the half-life, I think, is 4.47 billion years. That's really close to 3.825. Close enough that we know we're going to get a really accurate date. If what you're dating is way off from the half-life, you'll get a much less accurate date.
The other part of this that I was interested in is the possible problem of contamination. That's what I was getting at. And the role that these samples, were contained in these zircon crystals, which precipitated. They could, I guess, and maybe you could talk about that a little bit more. Is that these life indicating substances were actually sealed into these zircon crystals that were found at least, and I know in Australia and maybe in Canada also, but that was very important, to my understanding, in keeping the contamination out of other materials.
Well, this is timely because I just submitted a paper to a peer-reviewed journal, and it's a secular journal, so it'll be interesting to see if they accept the paper where I talk about the origin and history of life in the context of what the science says and the Bible says. And I did bring up the issue of the zircons. That date of 3.825 billion years ago, it's based on looking at samples of rocks, apatite rocks in Greenland. But I look at that as a secure date because it's based on the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13. The interesting thing about organisms, they prefer the light isotopes to the heavy isotopes. And so the postbiotic form of a molecule will have a higher ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13. But what happened there in Greenland, they not only saw an isotope signature for life in the carbon isotopes, they saw it in the nitrogen isotopes and the sulfur isotopes. So they saw a higher ratio of sulfur 32 to 34, a higher ratio of nitrogen 14 to nitrogen 15. They also had an abundance, or is an abundance of this isotope evidence, which basically told them, not only do we see three independent signatures that life dates back to 3.825 billion years ago, but it's an abundance. Now, complementing that is some evidence that's discovered near Great Slave Lake in northern Canada, where they found these zircons. And one of them is indicating an excess of carbon-12 to carbon-13 that dates to 4.0 billion years ago, another one to 4.1 billion years ago. The error bar is fairly big. It's not anywhere near as what you see in Greenland, mainly because they had an abundance of the isotope evidence. What we see in the zircons in northern Canada is the sample size is small, and so they're saying 4.0 plus or minus 0.1 or 0.2 billion years, 4.1 plus or minus 0.2 billion years, so it's not as accurate, and it's based on only one isotope, the carbon-12 to carbon-13 ratio. It is such, however, that it demonstrates that it indicates that there were at least brief episodes of liquid water that date back approximately 4 billion years ago. And it may be a signature of life, it may not. So it's something that is still kind of tentatively held by the scientific community. Whereas the one that's at 3.825, there's such an abundance, it's at three isotopes are saying yes. And that's cited as the first evidence for stable life on planet Earth, because that's the first time in the history of the Earth that you've got permanent liquid water and permanent rocks. What these zircons that are older are telling us, there are brief episodes earlier than 3.825 billion years ago where you briefly had liquid water in one location, where you briefly had solid rocks in one location, and possibly maybe even a signature of life at that time. Which is one reason we titled our book Origins of Life Plural, because we're open to the possibility God may have done several origins of life. He may have created life as early as 4 billion years ago, knowing that it would be quickly stuffed out, because that would actually jumpstart the transformation of Earth's atmosphere, which would help future life. I think that's a possibility. I also think it's possible that the zircon evidence really is not establishing the existence of life that early. But it is possible that it's establishing a limited amount of life that exists only for a brief time. 3.825, that's evidence for abundant, permanent life on planet Earth. And, you know, what I'm commenting on in this paper is what I find interesting from a biblical perspective, the moment you have stable liquid water, the moment you have stable rocks, you immediately have life, and you've got life in abundance. It's a diversity of microbes, not a single microbe, because we actually see a spectrum of carbon-12 to carbon-13 ratios, because some life forms would exhibit a different isotope ratio than others. What I can tell you is at 3.825, you've got both anaerobic microbes and aerobic microbes. You've got both. And you know, there may even be evidence for sulfate-reducing bacteria that early. It's an ecology of microbes, not a single microbe. The atheists would claim all life is descended from a single microbe. We don't see that in the Greenland evidence. It's an ecology, and it's an abundance of microbes, not just a tiny population of one microbial species. So That's the latest in terms of what that is. In terms of these ancient zircons, I think is wait and see. We're going to have to find more zircons to see what's happening. But we already know that previous to 3.8 billion years ago, the predominant condition of planet Earth is that it was hellishly hot, too hot for liquid water, too hot for solid rocks. But there may have been regions on planet Earth where you briefly had liquid water and solid rocks.
Hugh, Jim Goddard wants to know, where did Neanderthals come from? Did they evolve?
Interesting is that Neanderthals ranged, they went extinct somewhere between, say, 42 and 48,000 years ago. 45,000 is the most frequently cited date. There's a little more uncertainty about how early they show up. No one says that they were any later than 250,000 years ago. But 250,000 to 400,000 years ago is the range when we see the first Neanderthals. Most of the papers I've read are comfortable saying they've been here at least since 300,000 years ago. But as you compare the fossil remains, the bones that we found in the Neanderthals that date to 250 to 300 to 330,000 years ago, and compare them with the bones that we found that are 45,000 years, they're the same. We can't see any distinction in the change of the morphology, the anatomy of the Neanderthals. So no evidence that they evolved over that period of time. You say, what about the genetics? Unfortunately, the genetic evidence is limited to the latest Neanderthals, basically from 45,000 years ago to about 120,000 years ago is where we got DNA evidence, and that DNA evidence is limited. In no case do we have the whole genome. We only got parts of the genome. But there again, when you compare from 120,000 to 45,000 years ago, we can't see any evolution in the DNA. So no evolution in the DNA, no evolution in their anatomy, and no evolution in their technology. I mean, if they really were human, you would expect that they would demonstrate rapid technological advance. But in terms of what we see 45,000 years ago to what we see 250,000 years ago, it's the same technology. Now, the one caveat on that is when you're dealing with, say, 40 to 48,000 years ago, there's a problem of trying to distinguish this artifact. Is it a Neanderthal artifact or is it a human artifact? So there are some papers published where people claim that Neanderthals were exhibiting technological advance, but it's all based on the very latest artifacts where there's a dispute. Is this artifact really made by a human or made by a Neanderthal? And there again, I think it's suspect, because if your only evidence for technological advance is in the last 5,000 years before they went extinct, when their population is very low, that's really not good evidence for technological advance when you see nothing like that before. But it's possible they're like the monkeys we see around today. They steal our stuff. So it's possible Neanderthals were borrowing artifacts that were made by humans.
Thank you, Hugh. Frank McInnes says, aren't there DNA markers that show that Adam and Eve came from Western Africa? In other words, all humans outside of Africa today have markers that are different from sub-Saharan Africans of today.
Yeah, that's a good point, and that's something that's being discussed in the scientific literature. Because if you look at the earliest artifacts that are unmistakably modern human, and likewise the DNA that's unmistakably modern human, we find it in the locations. It's basically Eastern Africa, some of it in Southern Africa, some of it in Arabia, some of it in the Levant, and some of it in the Persian Gulf area. But what I've documented in several articles I've written, there's three episodes during the earlier two-thirds of the last ice age where there was easy migration routes connecting the Persian Gulf, the Levant, Arabia, and Eastern and Southern Africa. That was a time when the sea levels were 300 to 390 feet lower. Therefore, there was a land bridge joining southwestern Arabia to Eastern Africa. And it wasn't just humans that could easily migrate back and forth. One of the articles you'll see up at reasons.org, there's a species of rats that we now know were rapidly migrating between Africa and the Persian Gulf area. So evidently they were taking advantage of the same easy migration route, which I think explains why we're seeing the earliest artifacts and the bones and the DNA in multiple locations, but the locations are all along that easy migration route. So in terms of the garden, people have been saying it's got to be Eastern Africa because that's where we find most of the evidence. Well, it's also a place where the evidence is most likely to be preserved. I think it's a jump to say that has to be the location of the Garden of Eden because that's where we find the most artifacts. It could be that's just the place where the artifacts are easiest to find. So I'm still comfortable putting the Garden of Eden in the Persian Gulf area, given how easy it would be for humans to move from there into Eastern Africa.
Thanks, Hugh. Jamaslama says, can we categorize the events of day one and two and three, et cetera, into some kind of chart? The events themselves, not necessarily the dates.
Well, there is a chart that you can see at reasons.org. We've done expressly that. We put the events of each of the 6 days on the chart, and we give you rough approximate dates for those days. So it's up on our website. Several of our volunteers have come up with their own charts, which lead to different dates, but they're all consistent on what happens on what day. Like when you get to day two, it's all about the water cycle. Okay, what's the earliest evidence we have for a complex water cycle? I say complex because I think Job chapter 37 and 38 is actually dealing with creation day two. So I think it's talking about a period somewhat later in the history of the earth than the first origin of life on planet Earth, where we not only have a water cycle, we have a water cycle as complex as what we see described on creation in Job 37 and 38. And so you can look at things like the great oxygenation event to help you get a clue for what happened. Bottom line is, creation day one is when you got light appearing on the surface of the Earth for the first time, which would allow photosynthetic life to take place. So I think the earliest microbes would fit there. Creation day two, you've got a stable, complex water cycle. Creation day three is when the first continents show up, and we've got a good date for that. It's consistent with the first great oxygenation event 2.45 billion years ago. And then you have vegetation proliferating on the new continents, basically telling us once you've got continents in place, vegetation begins to proliferate on those continents. Creation day four is when the atmosphere goes from hazy to transparent, where you can now have animals that can take advantage of the position of the sun, moon, and stars in the sky to regulate their biological clocks. That's day four. Day five is when God actually creates the first animals that can take advantage of that transparent sky, that need to take advantage of it to survive. And in creation day five, we have a sequence first as animals in the oceans, and then the birds and the sea mammals. Then creation day six, it talks about three subcategories of advanced land mammals, those that are crucial for launching and sustaining human civilization. And last of all, the text describes God creating Adam and Eve. So that's basically what's on all the charts.
Thank you so much, Hugh. We've only got a couple of minutes left. It's not really enough time for another question, so you can have the rest of the afternoon off. Would you close us in prayer?
And I'll take advantage of those 2 minutes to try to write another article or part of an article. All right, Father in heaven, thank you for this time that you've given us today. Thank you, Lord, for every day that you give us to live here on planet Earth. Help us, Lord, to count that as a privilege. Help us too, Lord, to live every day for your purpose. Lord, thank you that you created this universe with a purpose. You created us with a purpose. Help us as we study your word. Help us as we study the book of nature to precisely discern what our role and purpose is here in this short life we have on planet Earth. And Father, help us to fulfill that purpose. Fill us with joy as we exercise that purpose. And Father, I pray for all of us here that are gathered that during this next week, during this next month, you would give us multiple opportunities to take what we've learned from you and to share it with people, that they too may come to know you as Creator, Lord, and Savior, and receive truth, life, and love from you. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.